Hello, I'm Douglas Frank, and this is part of our Spotlight on Members project, and I am pleased to have Mitra Lee Worley with me today for a bit of a conversation. So, Mitra Lee, welcome, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
So how did you connect with the Buddha Dharma? How did you come to the Buddha Dharma?
It was a long time ago, so I may have my facts slightly off. But I entered the Dharma by way of my interest in the work of Gurdjieff.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I entered his work through the books I was reading on Uspensky's work.
In Search of the Miraculous.
Exactly. That was exactly the book.
And yes.
Then I started reading, of course, the works of Gurdjieff, which I couldn't understand, but also the works by students of his and how he had worked with them. And that really talked to me somewhere, but I didn't. I joined a group, and I was being a dutiful practitioner. I didn't have any reference points about good or bad, but the group was kind of, the teacher was a student, I guess, of Gurdjieff, but he was very, Dutch, which was not a problem, except that, you know, the women did the dishes, and they made the meals, and they cleaned up, and they had babies, and the men fixed the cars, and they built the buildings and so on. And I was somewhat of a rebel as a young New Yorker actress thing, you know. And so I wasn't completely comfortable, but I did like his ideas. So that's kind of how I got introduced to having a spiritual path. And I got
when would this have been roughly?
Roughly. Well, it have to have been about 1969, something like that.
Okay. And was the community in Pennsylvania?
No, it was in New York State.
Okay.
And we would a bunch of us would drive up and spend the weekend up there.
Okay.
And, you know, do the cooking and the cleaning and so on and clean up afterwards.
Okay.
Anyway, it was good for me. But then I moved to New Mexico and continued. They did have a small group out there, so I continued on with that group. But I knew nothing about Buddhism until later. I connected with Trungpa Rinpoche a little bit because, this is a good story, I think. One of the members of the theater company that I was part of, you know, it's called the Open Theater, was a man named Jean-Claude Venitali, who's a playwright. And he had an ex-girlfriend or fiance or something from high school who was kind of not a member of the group, but an ex-friend, you know, who would help us with costume props and stuff. Anyhow, she left New York and went to Europe at one point early on in our time together and happened to get interested in Buddhism and in Samiling, which is where Trungpa Rinpoche was. And she and other people were instrumental in bringing him to the United States. So naturally, when he came to the United States, he was kind of brought around to see the theater company. And at that time, I was not interested in doing anything other than what I was doing, which was acting. Mm-hmm. And my attitude towards this little guy was that he could use a few voice lessons. Seriously, where my mind was at. But he was just very new, and his voice was, you know, he had had this car accident, and I think it had damaged his vocal cords. And at that point, I think he was still somewhat recovering, although I don't know that for sure. So anyway, that's how I met him. But how I met Buddhism, I think, was a story that one of the other people that had picked him up from Scotland and brought him to the United States, told about his experience with Trungpa Rinpoche. And it's such a wonderful story. I would love to tell it.
Oh, please do.
A story. Yes. Okay, so we're in Bhutan. This guy who's telling this story is telling about himself at the time he was an attendant to Trungpa Rinpoche. And it's night, and he and another attendant, who I think was Tibetan or could have been Bhutanese, I don't know, but anyway, not a, a Westerner, and Trungpa Rinpoche are walking along a very narrow path on the side of a hill in Bhutan. And Rinpoche is walking in front, and these two attendants are walking behind, and they're having an argument about who is the proper one to be holding the flashlight for Rinpoche. And this goes on, I gather, for some time in the dark, and no, I'm supposed to be, Anyway, at some point in this journey, Trungpa Rinpoche turned around, grabbed the flashlight, and threw it off the cliff. And there was something in that that made me feel like I was on to something that I wanted.
Mm.
I can't really say what it was, and there was a long time between when I heard that story and when I really met Trungpa Rinpoche, which was, I think it might have been in 1973.
Okay.
There were people in Boulder, Colorado, which is mm-hmm. where at that point Rinpoche was. And one of the people who was there was Jean-Claude from my theater company. He had been asked by Trungpa Rinpoche to get a grant so that he could put on a theater conference. And I happened at that time to be living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with a little baby and a difficult life because I didn't know anybody there, and I had cabin fever, I guess you could say, being a young mom with no friends, and just starting to create a theater company so that I'd have a little of my own self back. And Jean-Claude invited me to come to this theater conference, which was hosted by Trungpa Rinpoche's theater club and himself. And I was, of course, delighted. So myself and three of my young actors drove up to Boulder to this conference. And for some magical reasons that I'll never understand, I got to hear Rinpoche talking about his view of how theater might be a very good vehicle for assisting in presenting the Dharma to the West. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what he was talking about really resonated with me, who has always felt that theater is a spiritual path for communicating things about society. And of course, Buddhism is certainly about living in the world. So I was very taken with that. In fact, all of my young men and I were very taken with it. So much taken with it all. I mean, it was an incredible mix of performers, because there were people from all the avant-garde theater companies there, and this little group of baby Buddhist theater people, the Mudra Theater, they were called. And they would corner me every once in a while and say things like, "We don't know what we're doing. We don't know what we're supposed to say." You know, it's another story for another time. But the upshot of it was that there was tremendous chaos. And out of that chaos, he suggested that only when there's tremendous chaos can something new be born. And I knew that, even though I didn't know I knew it. I sort of vowed that I'd come back. And the next summer, luckily enough, Naropa Institute started. And one of the members of the Open Theater who had been at this conference was invited to teach theater at the Naropa Institute summer program. Mm. At that time, the summer program consisted of two 5-week periods. And he was only able to come to one of them. So he asked if I would be willing to take his place and teach the other one, which happened to be the first 5 weeks of the Naropa Institute summer. And of course I said, absolutely. No question about that. And I got up and started taking classes in Buddhism and started listening to Trungpa Rinpoche talking Dharma, basic meditation and so forth. And that's pretty much the gist of it.
So you were in the pre institute moment of this first sort of theater gathering, and then the institute, Naropa Institute, comes out of that. So you
well, not, I don't think exactly that the Naropa Institute came out of the theater gathering, but as you know, Trungpa Rinpoche made a lot of things start.
Right.
Sowed a lot of seeds in a lot of different directions.
Yeah.
And one of them was feeling like there must be a better way to educate than just this kind of head only sort of stuff that was the style in the time.
So theater was a real entryway into becoming a student of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche.
Well, in fact, my attitude at that time wasn't so much I wanted to be a Buddhist as I was grateful for the terminology that Buddhism was offering, because these things that were being said were things I was trying to do theatrically but didn't have any language for. So I wanted the language so that I could actually teach what I was trying to teach in terms of my own work.
So what would be some of the language that you
just learned? Very simple things. I mean, just the idea that the basic, shall we say, disturbed emotions are called passion, aggression, and ignorance is so helpful, because, you know, if you're an improvising performer, to know that you're pulling it toward you, or you're pushing it away from you, or you're pretending it's not going on, is so much quicker than trying to have this kind of old-fashioned idea of remembering when you were a child and your father rejected you, you fell in love with your, you know, or whatever. So it was so helpful, the psychological understandings that come from basic Dharma practice just are truly what are the truth of the way human psychology works, with no added padding. And that's been wonderful for teaching.
What a wonderful way to come into the Dharma in that way. It's like psychological, and it seems to me very embodied, physical, energetic.
That's definitely my gripe with being on Zoom all the time. I mean, I'm a teacher who teaches learning through the body and voice and awareness of space, you know, and here we are all locked into these little boxes, and I'm wanting somebody to invent round boxes so that we at least have some flow of a feeling on this Zoom.
Right. I would love that. That would
be amazing. Isn't that a good idea?
Anyone in Zoom world who's watching this who could do this, please.
Yes. And
round
I want copyright.
Round it so that it were more round.
Round or oval. Oval would be okay.
Oval.
Just something with a little, you know, flow.
Right. Softer. A little softer.
Yeah.
After. That would be nice.
Yeah, it would be.
So after that initial working there with, you know, for that 5 weeks, then how did you get more involved with Naropa out of that?
Okay, well, it was a wonderful summer, and I learned a lot. And felt very much like I had to connect more, but I didn't really have much of a way of figuring out how to do it, except that I was invited back the next summer to teach. And so, of course, I went. And at that time, there were discussions underway about a year-round program. And I was involved in some of that. And when the year-round program started, which would have been in the early winter of 1976, I was invited by Rinpoche to lead the theater program, or whatever. It wasn't much of a program at the time, but to be in charge of that.
Okay.
The other thing that happened to me was that the second summer, after this conference — I should go back to the theater conference for a moment — after the conference, Rinpoche and his theater students stayed together for a good time, maybe as much as a week or something, practicing a set of exercises that he was developing from his training in monastic dance. And they were training with these exercises. And there was something in those exercises that I saw because I was taking a class that was being presented in them, and also I saw in the performance that that group put on in the summer of that second summer. It's not so much that they did a good job, it was terrible, but the presence of the company as they came into the space to begin the show was stellar. I mean, by any theatrical degree. And, you know, we often talk a lot about presence in the theater. So, blah, blah, blah. If you have presence, you maybe have a chance of making it. If you don't have presence, too bad. Well, I happen to have presence, but on the other hand, if I have it, why doesn't everybody have it? That's bullshit, you know? So, I saw presence there. And
That
was really confirming to me about something that I was looking for. So I went back. I went back and moved to Boulder, and I've lived here ever since then.
One of the future conversations that I would love to have is to pick up this thread of your teaching at Naropa and the space awareness practices. It sounds like sort of the seed for that came out of that watching and being a part of the theater company.
Definitely. Yes. That and meditation. I mean, because at the time Naropa Institute was beginning and trying to find its way, the people who Rinpoche had asked to lead programs and so on were all somewhat professional in their academic pursuits or artistic pursuits, and very much new in the sitting practice of meditation and in the basics of the Buddha Dharma philosophy or psychology. So we had a lot of wonderful, wonderful discussions and late night, discussions, I guess is sort of a word, about these two things and how they would go together in various disciplines and so on. That was
I would love to pick up that thread in a future conversation.
Yeah. No, it's more than an hour's worth of talking.
Well, that would be fabulous. Okay. So I'm going to just keep that on my checklist and we will do that.
I accept your offer.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. Oh, great. So at some point, you became a student of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Is that correct?
I don't know at what point I became a student of his. I think it was way back when he threw the flashlight off the cliff. But those things are, you know, they're like that. But yes, definitely, I studied and practiced with him, and I very much got involved with the Mudra Theater Group, and we did productions of several of his plays over the course of time, and you know, people came and went, but we worked hard at it.
I saw a couple of the major theater productions, and it was, let's just say, it wasn't entertaining.
No, they were not designed for entertainment purposes.
It was not entertaining theater. And I remember the first time it was, whoa, what's this about?
Now, which and one was that?
Oh, it would, I don't remember.
Well,
it had been in the early 80s.
Do you remember where you saw it?
I saw one at, it was during Midsummer's down at Hogan's Farm.
Oh, yeah.
That one is very vivid.
Very short, though.
Very short.
Well, that was the period of time when he wrote two of these almost dance dramas that are very much based on the way a midsummer entertainment in Tibet would happen. Okay. That, you know, there would be a kind of a dharmic dance drama that would happen during the course of the summer. The first one he wrote in celebration of the visit of the 16th Karmapa to the United States. Mm-hmm. And the second one was more to kind of celebrate the four dignities, tiger, lion, Garuda, dragon, of the Shambhala iconography that was at that time beginning to be shared with his Sangha.
Okay. So after, we're just fast forwarding here through a whole lot of time.
Yeah.
After the death of Trungpa Rinpoche, what was your dharmic connection at that point? And I'm curious how you connected with Dzogchen Rinpoche.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, for a long time, Trungpa Rinpoche Parinirvana was in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, I figured I didn't need to have the teacher alive. He was my teacher, and he was my teacher, and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was a long time. Then about 10 years after that, I attended a talk by some lama or something, and I heard him say something to the effect of, one really needs a living teacher.
Mm.
So I heard that. And at the same time, I was in fact enrolled in the religious studies department at Naropa University, getting a master's degree, because that was a benefit that us underpaid faculty could get there.
Right.
So I was getting my master's in religious studies with an emphasis in Tibetan language. And I was taking courses with this guy named Punlop Rinpoche. And I heard this about you need a living teacher. And I was at a point in my own practice where, at least within the Shambhala community, you there's a choice to be made at the end of a long, lengthy curriculum. You can go one way or you can go the other way. And I felt it was ridiculous for me to be making up my mind which way I should go, since I didn't know anything about either way. And So I asked Punlop Rinpoche, who I was taking classes with, if he would be willing to give me some advice about which way to go.
Mm.
And he agreed to give me the advice, but he never gave me the advice. We had a meeting, and he gave me a sadhana practice, a guru yoga, Karmapakshi guru yoga practice to do in retreat. Mm. And I guess I don't know, really, to tell you the truth, I did it. And when I was out of retreat, he asked me to complete a compilation of instructions for the manual to accompany the Karmapakshi Guru Yoga. And I did that. And my friends, Cindy and Carol and Robert, were sort of hosting Punlop Rinpoche and TAing for him in class and stuff. And they invited me to come and sit with them. And so I did that. And it was nice to sit with them because I felt uncomfortable sitting with the Shambhala people at that point. It didn't, I wasn't, I don't know. It was something wasn't working very well. Anyway, so then they needed somebody to be the practice coordinator. So I said, okay. And I got a call from Mark who, you know, said, would I be willing to be the national practice coordinator? And I said, okay. And so that's how that happened.
One baby step after another, so to speak.
It's been like that from the beginning, you know. It's been like that since the flashlight flew off the cliff. And it continues.
I had never heard that story. Now that story is going to stay with me. So thank you for that. I love that. And it's so, it seems I can see Trungpa Rinpoche doing that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can see him doing that.
Yeah. Who wouldn't do that?
Oh, yeah. And just
that's the thing you would do if you were doing what you should do in that situation.
Right.
And I think that was really what really sold him to me, because I remember in that first summer when I was taking meditation classes, a huge, you know, audience of people, but I remember thinking, this person is probably the closest I'll ever get to Gurdjieff's approach to teaching.
Okay.
And because Gurdjieff, of course, was dead a long time before. Right. And, but something in that was a connection for me.
You're the first person that, I was reading Gurdjieff's stuff way back when. And you're the first person who has sort of connected up Gurdjieff and Trungpa Rinpoche. So that's beautiful. I appreciate that a lot. So how did you become a Mitra? And what is a Mitra for all us non-Mitras?
Well, it's easier to say how I became one.
Okay.
So I'll start with that.
That sounds good.
I became one because Rinpoche was told by his guru, Kenpo Sultum Gyamso Rinpoche, that he should appoint some Western teachers because he only had Tibetan teachers, students of his who were teachers. Mm. And so Rinpoche appointed five people to be what he labeled Mitras. Mm-hmm. And I there was myself and another woman and three men, but mm-hmm. the other woman didn't feel like she wanted to do that. So there's one woman and three men.
Amen.
At the moment. Hopefully that won't last much longer. We're working on having some more people to help us, but that's how nothing. Ask my permission.
Oh, okay. Was there a little ceremony to?
So there was a paper that says all that stuff that I'm one of them. Uh-huh. I've asked him a couple of times in various circumstances about maybe it's time to retire. When I asked him that 2 years ago, he told me I was already retired. So that didn't work as a way of leaving the post. What I'm a little embarrassed to say this because I'll say it though because it's important in terms of what is a Mitra. When Punlop Rinpoche asked Kenpo Rinpoche, his teacher, what criteria should he be looking for in appointing these Western teachers, and Kenpo Rinpoche told him compassion. So that's why I'm embarrassed, because I don't honestly, maybe what is really meant is people who really need to be having their feet held to the fire in order to develop compassion. And in that case, I definitely deserve this challenge. But what a Mitra is still a work in progress, I think. The four of us are very, very different. We have Mitra Karl is an awesome academic, I guess you could say, translator from the Tibetan into Buddhism. He probably knows as much as any of the Tibetans that study in the Shedras of India. Mm-hmm. Mitra Tyler is our youngest one, but he's also a translator, has done some beautiful translation work and writing, but is also Rinpoche's translator, mm-hmm. person to person, in person translation. Mm-hmm. And then Mitra Mark is a student once upon a time of Trungpa Rinpoche and of his regent. And I would say his genius is he's really, he should run for president.
Mm.
He's a very good politician in the sense of honoring and serving and believing in people. Mm. And then there's me, and all I can say is I guess they needed a woman as well, and I serve that purpose. And also, I think feminine principle a little bit, kind of a quality of space that I seem to have as a just a sort of natural thing. Mm-hmm. And we're not necessarily all that great as individual, we're not realized beings in any way, but when we are forced to work together, the combination of us is pretty good. We have we have different approaches and different ideas and so on, but when they're put together, there does seem to be a bit of wholesomeness about it. So I would say that we're kind of you know, in training as Buddhist teachers. So that's a Mitra in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you'd hear different stories from each of the other ones.
Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to.
Yeah.
That would be, that's part of my hope is to interview each of the Mitras, because it hasn't been done before.
No, it hasn't.
So I am very appreciative that you are willing and are the first one to step forward into Zoom Mitra world.
Zoom land, yeah. Well,
Zoom land here, so.
When I'm talking about things like we're talking about, I feel very blessed in my life to have been given such wonderful teachers and such wonderful training. And I don't know what I must have done in the previous life to deserve it, but.
Mm. That's beautiful. Is there anything further that you would like to say?
About
anything?
These topics or?
Anything. Anything at all.
Well, you had a question in our original set that was intriguing and difficult, which was how has the Buddhist practice and study that I've done, how does it work, or is it working or something in this time when we're somewhat in this enforced retreat from business as usual?
Right.
And if there's time, I could just.
Oh, please do. Yes, please.
Say a little bit about it. I think I feel extremely responsible to work on myself in this period of time. First of all, because I'm not getting any younger, although Rinpoche says, Lee, you're getting younger every day. But I fear that what it means is I'm getting closer and closer to the next life. But anyway, I feel a tremendous amount of responsibility to work on myself in this time. And I feel also a tremendous sense of, I guess you could say, sympathy and sorrow for folks who don't have information about working to tame this monkey mind that we start with, and train it in a direction that can actually be of benefit to themselves and others, and to make a little bit of progress towards more sane society and more sane lives and more of a sense of the whole and the interconnection of all of us and all of it. And so naturally, when anxiety comes and fear and panic arise, there's no tools to take advantage of the time. Mm-hmm. Like that story I told about the craziness of the theater conference and how out of that he felt that something new could arise, because right. when everybody's on groundless ground, mm-hmm. then there's a gap and the new birth can arise. And right. I wish I could communicate that as strongly and as clearly as possible, because we do have an opportunity right now to begin to reimagine and reconfigure things that we've really messed up. We can do it, but so many people don't have the tools and don't know those tools exist. So.
Yeah, that's well said. I feel very blessed in the good fortune that I've had in my life to have had Trungpa Rinpoche and Punlop Rinpoche sort of pointing the way, like, oh, wow. It is possible to be more sane. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I'm going to take you up on the offer to go through some of these threads through Naropa and whole space awareness practice. Yeah. And so we will book this in.
Okay.
And if you're listening to this, look for that.
Yeah, look down for the that. Thank you so much, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, so thank you. I was looking forward to this because we've never had these kinds of conversations before.
No.
So I don't know why, but we haven't, but thank you. Thank you for your willingness and your openness. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.